Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the renowned voice coach, Patsy Rodenberg. Her work at the National Theatre and the RSC has spanned decades, and her students include Judy Dench, Ian McKellen, Maggie Smith and Daniel Day-Lewis. A shy child with a speech impediment herself, she was dispatched to elocution lessons, only to be met by a disappointed teacher who said, "Oh dear, you will never speak." Well, she proved her wrong and then some. And her work's not all with famous actors. Businessmen, politicians and even criminals have been on her client list too. She says, "Everyone comes onto the planet with a fantastic voice, but people lose it. You don't know how good a teacher you are until you teach people who know very little." So for you, Patsy Rodenberg, what does the voice tell you about someone?
I suppose where they're blocked. If you think of a baby's voice, this amazing instrument, and then life gets to you and our habits crowd in on us and they crowd into the body and the breath. But the good news is that the natural wants to come through you. That I talk about the natural voice as opposed to the habitual. People will come in, you know, with their voices like that, and they say, "This is my natural voice." Back in, I said, "No, it's your habitual voice. You have a very free, open voice if you can let go of certain things."
And so that must start. I mean, if we think even about our own friends as children or our kids' friends, people's voices seem to start to change very early, do they?
Very early, yes. Mm. Some people, of course, don't have that because nobody's told them to shut up. It's as simple as that. I mean, it's more complex, but it is as simple as that.
When you hear somebody specifically with a speech impediment, what's going through your head then? Are you immediately linking that to something deeper in their personality?
I'm a pragmatist. I'm very practical. What I do is I look at the body. I look at the breath system particularly. And I start to try and diagnose where that blockage is. It mostly is in the breath. But you have to graft at it. I'm a bit of a plodder. I'm a bit of a donkey. You have to work something out. But if somebody has an appalling voice or speech habit, that builds up until it becomes very critical. And the interesting thing is, a lot of actors go into acting because they have those problems.
Because they are subconsciously drawn to fixing them?
Yes.
Right. One of the things you have dealt with is stage fright. I mean, it occurs to me that actors are right to be frightened. I mean, it's a terrifying thing they're doing.
Yes, and I think every performer goes through those moments. You have to stand sometimes in the wings with somebody and you have to centre them and get them going. And if they take a breath, they've got a chance. If they don't, they won't get on.
I've heard Dame Judy Dench say that the longer she does it, the more terrifying it gets. Is that a familiar pattern?
Yes, I mean, that's because actually you become more famous. I remember Judy saying to me, "I just realised," she said, "everyone's come to look at me."
Yes.
That's a terrifying notion, really.
Let's go to the music then, Patsy Rodenberg. Your first disc of the morning is what, and why have you chosen it?
Mahler. I've asked for the fourth movement of the fifth. I love Mahler. I'm really self-educated in many ways because I had wonderful parents, but there were no books really in the house and there was no music. So I've always just discovered my own things. And I discovered this before Death in Venice. So I was very angry when everyone else discovered it. But I remember going to a concert with a mentor of mine, Ronald Eyre, the great director, like a lot of great people, very difficult, but my goodness, he taught me a lot. And I think his wisdom stays with me, and every day I think about him in some way.
Thank you. The fourth movement of Mahler's Fifth Symphony, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. So, Patsy Rodenberg, never before has the spotlight shone so brightly on your profession. I'm thinking of the King's Speech and all the attention that came with it. Was that something you delighted in, or did you think it was rather an overly simplistic interpretation?
No, it's very good, isn't it? Because it tells people out there that maybe you can break through. I think so many people come to me and they think that they're trapped in this problem.
A lot of the treatment that we saw in The King's Speech, bearing in mind, of course, it was a Hollywood depiction, but it was very physical. The
yes.
treatment for a speech impediment was very physical that he received. Is that accurate?
To a certain extent, it's very visceral and sensual, the voice. It's a big activity. You need oxygen. You need blood to speak well. The great thing about actors is that they'll do anything for you. If you say to them, lie on the floor, do that, they'll do it. But of course, if you work with a politician, you can't say, lie on the floor. You have to find the way in. That is your job as a teacher, to enable, to empower. And I suppose the physical voice, I started with a physical voice. I taught in prisons when I was very young. I don't know how I got in there, but it was terrifying. And I had a big awakening that I realised that people also lost their voices politically and psychologically and emotionally.
When you are teaching politicians, then, do you have to have a degree of sympathy with what it is they want to say?
Yes. And by the way, you can't teach anybody unless you care about them. That doesn't mean to say that you're strokey-strokey. No teacher should want to be liked. It's like parenting. If you're going to make somebody move to a place that is difficult, you do it with, hopefully, a lot of compassion and love, but also you have to do this. So you have to take them on.
Let's talk then about the prisoners that you
yes,
have
yes.
helped. Can you think of a moment when you've actually reached, you know, the breakthrough, when you think there is somebody who, when I walked into this room this morning with them, couldn't look me in the eye and was either unable to articulate or unwilling, and here we are now at this point?
Absolutely, and it's often with Shakespeare. I did some work on Hamlet in a top security prison, and the guy playing Claudius was a murderer. And he spoke, "Oh, my offence is rank, it smells to heaven." And he just broke. I worked with a brilliant man called Dr. Murray Cox at Broadmoor, and he used Shakespeare all the time to actually take people into another room of understanding themselves.
Do you get a sort of collective sigh of despair, though, I wonder, when you walk into a, you know, I don't know how you work in prisons, but if, you know, if it's a room with a few people in it and you say, well, try reading this, or here's a bit of Shakespeare. I mean, we know that levels of dyslexia in prisons is, you know, stratospherically high. A lot of people there who can't even read and write their own name.
But they can make sounds. They can breathe. They can start opening themselves up. We can't ask people to be sensitised to others unless they're sensitised to themselves.
Time for another disc. Tell me about our next piece.
OK, Sandy Denny. Well, Goddess. I saw her perform. I was about 18, maybe 17. I hung around Fairport Convention. I also was working in a library. I had 2 years off before I went to college. And I was in this building with very talented people. There was a great singer there, a writer, a musician. And it was a very clear view that I got, which were people who hadn't followed their heart. And I knew instinctively that getting into Central was a chance that I should not ruin.
For who knows where the time goes? Who knows where the time goes?
Sandy Denny and Who Knows Where the Time Goes. You were blissfully transported during that.
Oh, goodness, what a voice, eh?
So, Patsy Rodenberg, let's go back then. It is 1953. You were born in the suburbs of London, it was, yes?
I was born in Pimlico, and then we moved out when I was about four.
And you were the middle of three children.
Yes.
What are your earliest memories of life at home?
I think happy. I had my Nana living with us. She was a very important feature in my life.
What was she like?
She was working class, Northumberland, very bright woman, but at the age of 12 she was apprenticed as a seamstress. And she used to sit in her rocking chair with a cigarette. She was one of those smokers that managed to get the ash right out there, but she would never spill it. And she would sit in the rocking chair sewing, saying, "I hate sewing." And she was in her 80s, and I used to think, oh, my God, you've been doing this for 70 years and you hate it. And the other thing about her, she was a great storyteller. She told me filthy stories that she never told my mother. And I used to work, here's a picture, I used to work for Shared Experience, wonderful theatre company. They had rehearsal rooms in the Soho Laundry. And one day I was going to teach there, and my mother said, "Where are you going?" I'm said, "Oh, the Soho Laundry." She said, "Do you know your grandmother used to wash other people's clothes in that building?" So I used to go there thinking, my goodness, I'm lucky. The ghost of my grandmother scrubbing other people's knickers in that building. So my grandmother, huge influence.
And your mother?
My mother, gorgeous woman. Again, working class, very bright. She got into a very good school in London. But her father, who had been a professional soldier, Coldstream Guard, used to stand outside Buckingham Palace, couldn't afford the uniform. But very bright woman, gentle woman, generous, sensitive. And what I love still about her in my memory is that she never moaned.
And your father had come to Britain from Holland.
Yes.
What did he tell you about his homeland?
Well, I get to know a bit now. I think the war, I mean, of course, if you go through occupation, terrible. He escaped that. He came to London to train at Sandhurst as an officer. Met my mother, very beautiful woman, fell in love, gave up Holland.
And he did talk to you about his experiences in the war then, did he? Because a lot of that generation simply refused.
Not really, right. Bits and pieces. I'm very delighted that my son now talks to him about the V2 rockets and the V1s. So he's getting a bit more information than I got.
And your father's still alive,
so
he's 87?
Yes.
No. You once said, girls are taught to be pleasing and not to be direct. Were you taught to be pleasing?
I think so, but I never was. My mother used to kick me under the table. I couldn't shut up. I never conceded. I never conceded.
It's a very interesting subject, I think, women and their voices. I mean, women, of course, are taught not to be loud and not to be, not to project.
But they're also
themselves.
Now taught to flirt, which is equally a problem.
Right.
I had a scene with a friend of mine in LA recently. He's got two daughters. And when they went to bed, I said, "You're flirting with your daughters. You don't want to bring up young girls of 6 or 7 that the only way they can talk to a man is by flirting."
And how receptive was the father to your observation?
Well, I think he's very good now. He takes a lot on the chin. But he does laugh. As long as I can make him laugh, I can say whatever I want.
Right, time for some music, Patsy. Our third disc of the day.
Beethoven, 7th Symphony. Now, we had one of those, do you remember those wooden stereo things?
Oh, yes.
And I remember my father sending off for a box of Reader's Digest records, 12 LPs. And I went through them all. Oh, my God, it was fantastic. And I've asked for the last bit of the 4th movement because it occurred to me, and again, I was about 12, I was listening to it and I got a wonderful idea that the music stopped, but actually it went on. It finishes, but it goes on in you.
Thank you.
The end of the final movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in A Major, performed by the London Classical Players, conducted by Roger Norrington. I mentioned in the introduction, Patsy Rodenberg, that as a child you had this speech impediment. What form did it take?
Well, I still have problems producing certain sounds, but it made me very shy, and it made me very interested in the process. And I have a real belief that we sometimes get excellent at something that we're frightened about. And I was frightened about speaking. I still am.
So you had what? You had a stutter or a burr?
I had a slight stutter, and I couldn't say my R's. I still find that difficult. And people laughed at me.
People openly laughed at you? You perceived
yes.
it?
Right. I was teased. I mean, teasing is a great part of... You have to deal with that in life, but it's not very... pleasant. I don't allow my students to tease. You have to, as a teacher, keep a very safe place so people can learn fearlessly.
It sounds very different from the elocution lessons that you yourself were given. Was that all the sort of the tip of the tongue, the deep
well,
in the lip stuff?
Yes, and mocking. Oh, my dear, you won't be able to do this, will you? Cruelty doesn't work.
So what was your response as a child when you
well,
were
I hated it.
Yes.
I asked... again and again, not to have to go.
So did you keep going to the elocution lessons, or did you manage to
well,
deal with
I went
it yourself?
Into drama lessons. I did other things, really. And then I went to the Central School of Speech and Drama.
Just before that, though, you were sent to... It sounds like quite a rather posh girls' school, was it?
No, it was chaos of an education. as my father said to me later, well, I didn't think a girl needed a good education.
Did he?
Yes. It was a private school. I had really blue-stockinged women. They wouldn't be allowed to teach today, but they were very inspirational. It was chaos on one level. I had a teacher who found me reading Reader's Digest. She took it away from me, she tore it up, and she said, "Your brain is too good for that. That is for lazy businessmen." And I thought, wow. And, of course, you can't teach like that, but sometimes you need a shock.
And what about parenting then? It's you're a mother to a young son. I mean, some people either, I think, tend to react against the way they were parented or can't help themselves doing it the same way.
Oh, it's a battle, isn't it?
Is it for you?
Well, I think I care that he's a very bright young boy and I don't want him to just go into the culture of watching television and doing all that stuff, but it's very easy to do all that. You have that battle all the time. But a brain has to be nurtured. You have to have stimulation. So I hope I'm stimulating him.
Some more music. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Bach's Violin Concerto in E major.
And why have you chosen this, Patsy?
Well, talking about Michael, he was 18 months. I was up with him at about 5:30 in the morning, making myself a cup of tea. And I thought, oh, I'll just put on some music. And I put this piece of music on. And I heard... him roar with laughter, joy. And I looked at him, I thought, what is he laughing at? So I turned the music off and he looked at me, focused. I thought, oh my God, he's laughing at the music, the pure joy of the music. So this is from Michael.
Andrew Manzi playing part of the opening of Bach's Violin Concerto in E major with the Academy of Ancient Music. You mentioned during that, Patsy Rodenberg, that your son, who is 8, is learning to play the violin. That's a brave mother who encourages her child to play the violin.
He asked.
Did he?
He wanted to.
Right, so he's artistic and musical.
Yes, he's in ballet companies and he's in theatre companies, so he'll probably be a banker, won't he?
Do you worry about the idea that your child might pursue a life in the theatre or in the arts? I mean, you know from the inside what a hard life it is.
Look, as long as he follows his dream, and this is very hard and I don't really want him to say it, but I will say it for myself, I think you have to be of use. I want to die in harness because I don't want to be a burden. I think you should be offering, even if somebody has to carry me, but I can tell them a few good stories, that will probably be enough.
And so is that why, because as you say, you went to drama school, but it was quickly clear to you, was it, that the teaching was of much more importance than the acting?
Yes, absolutely. I felt I could be an excellent teacher, and I thought it was useful.
At what age?
20.
You sound like a very mature 20-year-old at that time.
I think I was, probably. I think I've always thought things very deeply. Didn't know that until quite recently, that it's not what everybody does. I don't think I was very popular. I'm sure that I was a difficult student to be with because I wanted to do the work. I'm not a gossiper. I'm not very good at chit-chat. I'm working with very famous people and they say, tell us the gossip. And I say, well, I don't know any gossip. And why would I tell you any gossip? Because if you work with somebody, you get a very strong relationship. So you wouldn't let anything out of the bag.
You said a moment ago that you've only learned very recently these things about yourself, that, you know, you were probably a very mature 20-year-old. What caused you to realise that?
Well, I think Michael coming into the world, this joy, I call him boy of boys, joy of joys, you know, he came into my life. I didn't think I was going to have a child. When I was married, I lost a child. So I didn't think I was going to have this in my life, and suddenly it's there. But you start to remember your own childhood.
Yes.
As he goes through things, you go through things with him.
And here's the interesting thing, of course, because I will talk to, and we all meet many men who have children when they're older than people normally have children. We don't often meet women who are in that situation. Do you actually feel that it is a richer, more useful and interesting experience because you have your son now?
Maybe. I don't know that for sure. I know that I was married. I was in a very difficult marriage, and if I'd had the child that I'd lost, it would have been very bad for the child and for me. So, in a way, you have to see the positive.
Time for some music. What's next?
Daniel Evans, ex-student of mine, doing Finishing the Hat from Sunday in the Park with George. He's a wonderful actor, wonderful student. He's running Sheffield Theatre at the moment. And I saw him do it on Broadway, and I was so proud of him because he stuck to the truth. You see, if you get in front of certain audiences, it can cheapen your acting. You could think, oh, I can get a laugh out of this. And he stayed on the text, on the work, and I went out for supper with him afterwards and I said, well, you held on.
Dizzy from the height, coming from the hat, studying the hat, entering the world of the hat, reaching through the world of the hat like a window. Back to this one from that, studying a face, stepping back to look at a face.
Daniel Evans and Finishing the Hat from the London cast recording of Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George. So, Patsy Rodenberg, you mentioned a moment ago this difficult marriage. You were at the Central School of Speech and Drama and you got married to
a teacher.
A teacher.
He was 25 years older than myself.
Right.
He was very charming, very good looking, witty. He introduced me to many people. Alan Bennett I met through him when I was young. Ronald Eyre. I used to go home and Ava Gardner was in the apartment. So I had a sort of interesting entrance into that world. The problem, he's a drinker, he was an alcoholic. And we all know, if you live with a drinker, at best it's boring.
Yes.
And then it's savage. And I walked out, and it took me probably 10 years to get over it. Do you remember the time when you had bank managers that would sit and have lunch with you?
Oh, yes.
And I remember this bank manager saying, I think you've got to go out and work very hard. You've got a lot of debts. So I did. He made me laugh a great deal. So that's the problem. I think I'd read too much Bronte. I'd been reading the Brontes a great deal when I'd met him. And I thought, oh, somebody difficult, but love will change them.
Yes.
And of course it doesn't.
Was there a moment when you realised that he wouldn't change for
Devastating.
You?
Devastating.
Yes.
Devastating. Because, of course, you can't... There isn't a switch in you that goes, oh, I've just switched off love. You still love somebody, but it was destroying me. And at the time, people couldn't believe I could leave him. They felt I should just carry on. But it was an act of survival. I just walked out.
And were you drinking too? Did you end up trying...
I did drink quite a bit. I don't think it was ever critical.
And to be with somebody who's that much older than you and is introducing you... the superstars of the day. You say Ava Gardner was in your flat. Is it true?
Drinking cocktails.
And was she watering the plants with gin? Is that, or vodka or something?
Yes. No, I think they were laughing.
You lost a baby, and you said that in a way, looking back on it, to have brought a child into that atmosphere would have...
Terrible.
Yes.
It was such a terrible time of my life.
Yes.
If I say to you that you go through these things, and later I would look at my diary, and I was, oh, I taught Daniel Day-Lewis in that time, and I'd forgotten that, because you're just trying to do that basic thing of get up every morning. Oh, I've got into the shower, that's good.
Yes, surviving.
Surviving. Mm. And to bring a child into that world would have been disastrous for the child as well.
Let's have some music, then. We're on the sixth of
Sibelius,
our
pieces. Yes. The violin concerto. So it just so happened that Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg, who's a friend, was over. She's a wonderful American violinist. And she was being very funny about when you hear the intro as a violinist to this, dum-da-rum-da-rum, she said, there's not a violinist in the world that doesn't break out in a sweat because it's so difficult. And I love that image because that's what I deal with all through my life. People, as soon as the beginner's call goes out, you've got to go on stage. There's no going back. But here she is playing passionate, wonderful violinist Sibelius.
Part of the third movement of Sibelius's violin concerto played by your friend Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Michael Tilson-Thomas. Patsy Rodenberg, we should also reel off a few more names. I don't know if you get tired with this, but I'm sure other people won't. Daniel Craig, Orlando Bloom, Joseph Fiennes, and so on and so on and so on. You work with a lot of stars a lot of the time. Does it ever overwhelm you to stand in a room with the greats?
No. No, I respect people, but I can't be frightened of them. How can you? You can't teach people if you're frightened of them.
Are they a little bit frightened of you?
Well, I hope not. Some people say they are, but I'm not at all frightening. I have tremendous respect for young people today. I think they get a bad press. But a lot of them have been trained to think that celebrity is easy. So they get very mortified when I say, well, you have to work harder. So you talk about Michael. If he shows me a picture... I'll say, that's lovely, that bit is really good, but a bit of work is needed down here. But that might be the hard thing.
But that's rather unfashionable these days. We're meant to smother them in love, are we not?
Well, it is love. I mean, I absolutely unconditionally love my students. They don't know it necessarily all the time. But you're going to be disliked if you ask somebody to go further. It's just like a child. If Michael is at a restaurant and he's misbehaving and he's spoiling the evening for everyone else, he goes home. And he's very angry in the taxi. But that's fine. You have to honour their talent, and you have to ask them to honour their own talent.
I can hear cheers going up near the radios around Britain, as you say.
Well, of course.
It is fascinating to talk to you about work, but I really want to talk to you about love, because you did find love. You've mentioned Michael, who is your son. He was born in 2003. Tell me about the big love of your life.
Antonio Franceschi, who is a brilliant ballet dancer, now a choreographer. I was at a party in New York. She was with her husband. And we talked for maybe 3 hours. And the next thing I know is that she arrives in London to find me.
Literally, that was the next thing that happened.
A letter. And then she arrived in London.
Good God.
And she's exquisite and beautiful. She is the most amazing dancer. I tell you, I respect everything about her. She did the movie Fame. She then got offered a Hollywood deal, millions and millions of dollars. But at the same time, Balanchine wanted her for New York City Ballet. And she chose the genius as opposed to the money.
And so she was clearly captivated by you, a letter and a journey across the Atlantic. But what did you think of Antonio the first time you met her?
Well, I'm not a predator. Obviously, I like men and women. That's what I found out.
But did you find that out only with her?
No, I'd had a few experiences before. But right. When I looked at her, she's not in my league, really. She's so beautiful. But I do remember a tremendous connection of spirit.
And so when she came to seek you out in London, did she sort of land on your front doorstep?
Yes. Well, she always laughs because she met me at the stage door of the National. I came out of the stage door and she was there.
Will you tell me what you said? What?
Yes, I remember, of course, very vividly. We went and we looked at the Thames. And I said, what are we going to do about this? And she said, well, let's see.
Let's have some music.
Well, we're going to Kathleen Ferrier. And again, I heard on the radio, again when I was about 10, and I never thought I'd heard a voice like that. And I said to my mother, can we get that? And we went and we got it, and it was full of folk songs. And a lot of the folk songs my grandmother would sing in a tobacco-saturated voice. And this my mother used to sing, it's the Keel Row. And my mother used to skip around the house to this. She used to dance.
As I came through Sandgate, through Sandgate, through Sandgate, as I came through Sandgate, I heard a lassie sing. As I came through Sandgate, through Sandgate, through Sandgate, as I came through Sandgate, I heard a lassie sing. We'll may the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll may the keel row that my lad is in. We'll may the keel row, the keel row, the keel row. We'll may the keel row.
That was Kathleen Ferrier and the Keel Row. You spoke right back at the beginning, Patsy Rodenberg, about this very strong bond, very important relationship you had with your grandmother. And you've referred to Michael, your son, talking to your father about his
yes.
early experiences. That must be an interesting thing to see then.
It's wonderful.
Yes.
It's wonderful. And I love the idea that he is speaking to somebody who went through the Second World War.
And what does Grandpa make of your relationship and the time?
He adores both Michael and Antonia. Of course, he just loves beautiful women. And what I love about my father is that he's a very social animal. If you point him in the right direction in a party, he will wag his tail. He's very happy in that way.
It must be a great relief for him to see you happy, because surely, I mean, marrying somebody who was 25 years older than
yes.
you and then being in a very tumultuous relationship must have been difficult for your parents to bear.
Yes, but of course they never spoke about it. They just, well, that's how people operate. They just, you have to get on with something.
Do you think you'll have more children?
No. No.
So Michael's going to get all the love.
He's going to get so much love. He has to, we have to watch that he's not spoilt.
I don't think he will be, judging by your parenting technique. It seems almost unbearably cruel, but I'm going to cast you away from Michael, away from Antonia. How on earth will you cope?
Will have to cope. I think I would spend a lot of time meditating and thinking and in contemplation. There's a spiritual side that I would nurture. It's unbearable, but there's a lot of unbearable things in life. I hope you leave a very positive legacy in teaching. That's what you're there for.
Let's have your final piece then.
Bach, cello suite. Michael was born to this music, so his cry was counterpoint to Bach. Antonia choreographed a piece to this and danced it. So those two memories will just come, will mingle together.
Jacqueline Dupré playing the opening of the prelude to Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G. So, Patsy, here we are with the books, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and what else?
Well, I've gone for the biggest anthology of poetry you can get me.
Right, we shall find that and we shall give it to you. And a luxury, of course.
I'm not allowed my trusty Swiss Army knife, am I? No.
No.
So a cup of tea, builder's tea.
Yes.
With a mug.
An endless supply.
Yes.
Would you like milk with that?
Yes.
Right, it's yours. And if you had to choose just one of these eight discs, which one disc would you pick?
Well, the laughter in the Bach, the violin concerto, the laughter, that it would bring back laughter.
It's yours. Patsy Rodenberg, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.